Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and we here in New York can say we knew David Paterson when? We knew him when he was Basil Paterson's up-and-coming son. We knew him when he was a state senator from Harlem and when he was Senate Minority Leader. Now David Paterson is the lieutenant governor of New York State, entering office with Eliot Spitzer, and there are even those who say if Hillary Clinton is elected president, Paterson is a leading contender to be appointed to fill out her term in the U.S. Senate. But that's getting ahead of ourselves. Lieutenant Governor Paterson, welcome back to WNYC.
Well, good morning, Brian. It's great to be here. And it's great that I was interviewed by you during all those periods.
That's true. So how's it going?
It's far more exciting than I expected. And I think that people are asking, what new role will the lieutenant governor play? Well, I'm playing the role. For the first time, the lieutenant governor spoke during the budget process this year. I'm with Eliot at most of his press conferences and the deliberations that precede them. And I'm working on issues such as minority and women's business enterprises, energy policy, which is probably critical in this state right now, domestic violence and stem cell research, and trying to get us a little more dedicated on the state level toward the arts, and issues with people of disabilities and Medicaid and the whole thing. So
I noticed that you did not stand behind the governor at his inaugural, as happened at Pataki's first inaugural with his lieutenant governor, but we'll just let that go.
Well, you know, I had a little help. As soon as I introduced the governor, Speaker Silver said to me, David, sit down.
A good Sheldon Silver, and when Sheldon Silver says it like that, I guess you do it.
Let
me probe you on some of those policy areas that you've been given responsibility for. One of them, I know, is a Women and Minority Business Initiative, correct?
Well, Brian, this is interesting. The states that have done the best with women and minority business opportunities, oddly enough, are the states of Texas, where when George Bush was governor, the number of minority businesses increased by an incredible margin. So I don't know what George Bush knows about foreign policy, but I know he knew how to develop minority and women's business opportunities. In Florida, they have the first statewide roundtable where they try to bring private corporations into state business by measuring their accountability for minority and women-owned businesses. And so what I love to say is that Jeb Bush may not know how to run an election, but he knows how to build minority businesses. Oddly enough, states like North Carolina, Alabama, Georgia, Tennessee, states with stronger Republican leadership have done well, except for New York State.
How?
In other words, contracting and making these opportunities available. New York State, the Department of Economic Development's last statistics, was that $11.6 billion was spent on discretionary contracts by the executive branch, and Asian Americans, who constituted 8% of the pre-qualified companies, in other words, they didn't need anything else but an opportunity, got 1% of the contracts. Hispanic Americans were 10% of the pre-qualified companies and got 0.75% of the contracts, and African Americans were 9% of the pre-qualified companies and got 0.66, which is 0.75% of the opportunities. And what's even worse than what happened to minorities are women, who are 50.8% of the state's population, got 2.6% of state contracts, while women's businesses have grown by 20% in New York State in the last decade.
And we know that women are so dominant in starting small businesses all over the country. So those are very interesting statistics. But how do you increase those numbers? How do you increase those numbers without discriminating against white male-owned businesses?
Well, I think that when we talk about the pre-qualified companies, we are saying that these people, in a sense, were discriminated against. In other words, this is one of those situations where we don't have to spend much money, and we don't have to change much. All we have to do is demonstrate through research that there's a disparate impact, which I think we've pretty much conducted that research. And then we just have to make opportunities available for contracts based on qualification and not pre-existing relationship with the state.
New York State Lieutenant Governor David Paterson, my guest on WNYC. You're also working on the governor's stem cell project, yes?
Well, right now in the New York State budget, we are looking to create a legislation that will call for a public referendum in 2008. It's a little too soon to do it for 2007, that will let the people vote on a $1.5 billion bond that would bring stem cell research and other medical and scientific research to New York, and also some economic development possibilities for upstate. And we're hoping that by observing what happened in California, we will be able to take advantage of perhaps some better ways to pass the legislation. And of course, right now, you know, the more we're reading about stem cells, how interesting they are, and when in the embryonic stage they can theoretically, hasn't been done yet, be grown into perhaps life-saving types of organs for people suffering from spinal cord severing situations, or diabetes, or you know, other diseases. And whenever there is the pursuit of invention, it isn't clear exactly where the research will take us. But we know that so often it's been the opportunity to let scientists govern their own research based on science and not policy or any other, you know, opinion. That's what we're trying to keep up with 40 states that are actually endeavoring.
And I guess with the bond issue, the presumption is that this is borrowing that's going to pay off over time because there's going to be an industrial payback.
Really, the economic development of this plan is as important as the research itself. And I think one thing that we're going to have to work out in the legislation is the fact that you really cannot have a bond act on an operation, and research is really a government operation. Mm-hmm. It has to be a capital project. So we want to tie the research into the economic development and the increase of jobs from the biotech industry and from just the colleges and universities whose programs we can fund.
So would the goal be to spread around that infrastructure around upstate communities, which we all know are doing so poorly, many of them, economically, or would you concentrate it in Albany, which already has this infrastructure? And Albany, people down here don't know, but is doing pretty well economically. And one of the reasons is the nanotechnology research center that's becoming a national hub, and that's located around my alma mater, SUNY Albany.
Well, since it's your alma mater, Brian, we're going to be sure not to leave it out.
That's right.
But also, Rochester is a place where there's a lot of medical and scientific research going on. And, of course, then we have some great centers of learning here in New York State, and we really don't want to lose either the talent of the researchers who are there now, or the institutions themselves to other states who are on this. They're doing this in New York, in New Jersey, and Connecticut, and of course, soon they'll be doing it in California.
So let me go down some of the Spitzer administration initiatives that are in the news and get your take on some of these things, okay? We'll go through these fairly quickly. First, the healthcare overhaul, and a lot of our listeners have probably seen the back and forth competing television commercials on this in recent days. The governor would cut about $1 billion from hospitals and nursing homes because Medicaid needs to be restructured. Everybody agrees about that. But the Hospital Association and the Healthcare Workers Union say if we have to make cuts, why not cut it from HMOs and pharmaceutical companies rather than hospitals and nursing homes and healthcare workers? So what do you say to the hospitals in 1199?
Well, I think that Elliot Spitzer debunked that argument the other day when he was speaking before the Association for a Better New York, when he said that they're cutting $500 million from the insurance companies and the pharmaceutical companies, and at a rate that is proportional to the cuts that are being made to the hospitals. Also, it seems to me that the cuts, while they are, you know, I'm not going to minimize the fact that they are cuts, they are really a necessary government function that we take at this time as we try to focus our attention more on the patients and not the institutions. And Elliot Spitzer, you know, just to shorten it, went through this point by point with a PowerPoint presentation I think was unprecedented, where he answered all these arguments with the union representatives and the hospital representatives sitting right there.
Well, I think it was Dennis Rivera, head of 1199, who said these are basically the same cuts the Democrats kept fighting against in the Pataki years. So here is the Spitzer-Patterson administration acting like conservative Republicans. Dems fighting words for you, I'm sure.
Yeah, absolutely, because while I don't think that my agenda has been compared often to conservative Republicans, but I will say this. All of us, Democrats and Republicans, recognized that we are the highest tax state in the union. We have more debt and deficit. When you add it all up, we have about 13% of our tax dollar going just to state government, which is higher by one-third than any other state in the union. And there just comes a point, because I did fight a lot of these cuts years ago, but I fought these cuts when our budget was in much better condition than it is now. And if we just continue to irrationally spend, like any consumer who overspends their credit card will pay for it down the road, or the next generation or the next administration.
But is there a Democratic or Republican way to make these cuts? Is this different than the way Pataki was proposing to cut maybe the same amount of money?
No, but when Governor Pataki came into office in 1995, the stock market had doubled in the last 5 years. The state was in surplus. The state was in a deficit when he first came in. But by the late 90s, we had a much better economic condition than we have now. That's one of the reasons he was able to cut taxes so effectively at that time.
Another topic, the workers' compensation deal. The governor says the new workers' compensation system will cost employers less, but actually provide injured workers more cash. And the unions and business leaders have both signed off on this. But how does that math work out?
Well, Brian, I think this was one of the more fascinating projects that I've ever worked on anywhere. On November 8th, the day after the election, at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, Elliot Spitzer and I met with Dennis Hughes of the AFL-CIO and with Ken Adams, the head of the New York State Business Council. We put together a working group, and they started working. And what they were able to do was to come up with some statistics and data. And they said that the model for this research over a four-month period of time was the math is the math. And they were able to recognize that permanent partial disability claims, which 15% of the claims spend 85% of the money, but 5% of the claims spend almost 60% of the money. That by curbing those payouts, we could actually reduce premiums and increase benefits at the same time, and also provide relief for some of the small businesses around the state. And to see a press conference with these noted adversaries standing up, lauding the governor's organizational skill. And when I sat and talked to them just one-to-one, what they said was that what Elliot Spitzer did in this brief period of time was to bring the parties together in an open exchange of ideas and opinions about how to do this, and to lay out what really hurts them, and maybe sometimes what they say hurts them but isn't really that much. And rather than just throwing a bill on the table, which is what I would say the past two administrations would do at different times, and saying take it or leave it, and the results have been staggering.
But when you say so much of the money goes to a few very serious cases, and my guest is Lieutenant Governor David Patterson of New York. Is it true that maybe there are just some people who are so sick that they need these resources? Do I understand correctly that some of the losers here would be workers who are the most seriously injured and so they're out permanently?
No, I think what we're going to be doing is keeping an eye on them. We're going to be regularly making sure that people who are out are really that sick because of the overwhelming burden on the system that these payments cause. And while it will still be a significant percentage of the payment, it will relieve us of some dollars that we can dedicate toward reducing premiums and increasing the benefits. I would compare it to in the general health care system, if we could ever find a way to deal with the problems of seniors and the problems of the disabled. Those two groups are small percentages of the population, but constitute a great deal of the health care costs. So it would be that kind See, that will be far more difficult because we are more assured that these individuals really suffer from long-term illness. But in the workers' compensation cases, it really has been lack of attentiveness and what I would say monitoring of the cases more than anything else.
We have a few minutes left with New York State Lieutenant Governor David Patterson. Before you go, can I ask about your disability in this job? I think you're the first legally blind statewide elected official. Do you get documents in special formats or anything like that?
Well, I'm certainly not the first disabled statewide elected official. President Roosevelt was, but I'm legally blind. I have optic atrophy. I have effectively no vision in the left eye, and my vision is a little over 20 over 400 in the right eye. So mostly people read to me, and I have a voicemail with extended time, so documents can be read for me. One of the big problems that I always had, even when I came on your show, Brian, mm-hmm. is that I wouldn't get a chance to read the morning newspapers. And what my staff does now is they take turns, they go through the clips, they try to digest them a little bit so they're not reading all the articles. And I've got about 10 or 12 messages I listen in the morning to get them. And I think that this higher profile struggle of an individual who's disabled to conduct business at their work will be an incentive to 29% of to the 71% of blind people who are unemployed, the 90% of deaf people who are unemployed, and the over 50% of people with ambulatory disabilities who don't have jobs. And I'm hoping that if in any way it does or shows employers that with a few more adjustments you can really make a difference. I hate for the cure for cancer to be in the brain of some little girl who's blind somewhere in Westchester that will grow up, get a college education, and can't find a job.
So you see yourself not only as a role model for employers to look at and say, I can hire sight-impaired people, but also, I presume, for sight-impaired young people who want to aim high.
Absolutely, and I think that one of the saddest things is that people who are disabled have a higher educational achievement on average than the national average, but probably have 40% of the jobs that their peers who don't have a physical disability have when they come out of school.
You're not a Braille reader, I guess.
No, because I have some vision. They had large print. I mean, it's like 24 and 36 fonts sometimes, but I was able to read that way when I was younger. At this point, after about 5 or 10 minutes of reading, I've become kind of exhausted. Mm-hmm. So I pretty much rely on CDs and tapes and people sitting across from me in an office reading to me.
Real quick.
And also, you get the benefit of the reader's commentary while they're reading to you as well.
Benefit or detriment.
That's right.
Real quick, there's been some reporting about you endorsing Senator Clinton for president, while Governor Spitzer says it's way too early to think about things like that. I guess you don't think it's way too early.
Well, no. This is my home senator, and as a Democratic Senate leader, I won back 4 seats from the Republicans with Senator Clinton's help, so just in a personal sense. And then I think her view is the best one, and I think she has positioned herself in the Democratic Party as the candidate that I think should be our standard bearer in 2008. And I think that that Governor Spitzer feels exactly the same way. I think that his remark that it's too early to endorse, it might have been easier if he'd said it's too early to endorse Hillary. But then again, if I'm wrong about this prediction, I'm in a lot of trouble.
You would be. You are presenting it as an inevitability, but I guess in general that's what happens. The politicians of a state line up behind, in this case, the favorite daughter.
The favorite daughter, and remembering that at the end of the campaign, that the favorite daughter or son is still in that same state with you.
And in this case, has a bit of power. All right, David Patterson, Lieutenant Governor of New York State. Thanks so much. Great to talk to you.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC coming up in a minute. How the Chinese Revolution affected Chinese food. And it did. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.